702.
Call us on 011-883-0702.
29 minutes to go before we get to 10 o'clock. Two things that I just want to remind you of that we can chat about in the open line. Number one is, of course, that turkey recipe that I requested at the beginning of the show. If you have any good turkey recipes, please do share those with me a little later on. A huge bird in the freezer. Still don't know what I'm going to do with it for Christmas, of course. And then second to that is also, lest we forget, today was the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction. Imagine that, the Great Conjunction, as they would say, some people referring it to it as the Christmas star, because that's when the two planets get to the closest, to the closest that they would be in about, 400 plus years. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. I've been watching it over the last couple of nights, and the weird thing is now that tonight is the 21st, the 21st of December, the night that it's at its maximum, quite frankly. Now, that's the night that I miss out on it because I'm sitting in the radio studio. Not that I'm complaining, but that's what happened there. If you've witnessed it, if you had an opportunity to look at it, if you have a nice telescope or a decent set of binoculars, do tell me about it. What did you witness and what did you see? But up next, a very important conversation that we're having, and that is, of course, as I said, with Dr. Harry Moultrie, Senior Medical Epidemiologist at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases Center for TB. And we're talking about the importance of adhering to COVID restrictions during the festive season, something that we, mentioned in brief or just quickly mentioned with Dr. Keith Kluter, we spoke to just in the last half an hour. Good evening to you, Dr. Harry, and thank you for joining us.
Evening, Gushwell, and evening to your listeners.
Awesome stuff. Thank you so much. And you sound, despite the difficult period that we're going through, you're sounding quite fresh and ready for a tough conversation, because I was saying to Dr. Kluter, in our previous chat, that unfortunately, I mean, today I was in a community. I won't now, name and shame and point to who and where and when, but people walking around without any masks on. And I was sitting and I'm thinking to myself, we're in the middle of a second wave. And now, to make matters worse, we have a second strain of COVID-19. And yet, clearly December is here and people are feeling the December spirit.
That's right, Bushwell. We're in for a busy Christmas season, and certainly the healthcare system is seeing it. I think it's, while people are tired and people are looking for some joy in their life and after a hard year and trying to find a way to recapture some of the Christmas spirit and see the year out, it's really essential that we do so responsibly. So certainly we want people to find ways to find joy, to enjoy themselves, but we need to do it responsibly. The second wave is well and truly upon us in a number of provinces, and individual responsibility now really is essential to protect not only ourselves, but also our families and our broader community, and to ensure that the healthcare service is able to cope.
I mean, the one thing that stands out for me is what you were saying there. And unfortunately, I hear what you're saying about people wanting to sort of de-stress, unburden themselves, just take a break from what has been a tough year. And then ordinarily, I guess, at this time of the year, it's been hard work. It's been tough coping with all the stresses and the issues that you have in the workspace, bills, money, finances, that type of stuff. But this year it was exacerbated, obviously, with us being under house arrest for quite a large portion of the year. Not through our own doing, but largely because of this virus that's airborne and so easily transmittable. Now, obviously, we're still in that situation, or we should still be in that particular situation. But unfortunately, as South Africans, we party hard, and we like our drink, and we tend to become very, very responsible when we have a couple of hopper in us, So that for me is really worrisome, because A, you're going to have a lot of people gathering, and B, you're going to have a lot of people gathering without masks, without the necessary social distancing, not just in their homes, but also in spaces where they can have a good time. And that is a bit worrisome.
Absolutely. And, I caught the end of Keith Clitter's interview. And I think It's really important for people to remember that with places, you know, in the Western Cape where our hospital systems are under enormous strain, that this is not only about COVID, right? We've got to think about our risks in terms of our broader health. This is not the time to be needing a hospital in the Western Cape for some other reason, whether it be for trauma, an accident, a heart attack from having, you know, a really good Christmas meal, overeating, overindulging, trauma, you name it. This is not the time to be looking for a hospital and a hospital bed. So the risks and the precautions we need to take are not only about preventing the transmission or acquisition of COVID or SARS-CoV-2, but also just making sure that we are aware of the substantial risks that we take when we get on the roads at the moment, because car accidents and traffic accidents are incredibly frequent at this time of year, and hospitals are under pressure. It's not. We really do need to take a careful look at our risks.
I mean, you've really highlighted such an important point. There's something I didn't even think of myself, because part of the reason behind the initial ban on alcohol sale during the first part of what was it called, level 5 of the lockdown, you know, which took us all by surprise. The reason why DOP was taken off the shelves and people couldn't get access to it in the first instance was because of that aspect, where the whole idea was, you know, because of your drunken misadventures, you shouldn't end up in hospital. And then as a result of that, you know, take up space that is needed for people who require any, you know, care for COVID. So whether it be in the emergency room, whether it be in an ICU unit, you shouldn't be taking up space that is really very much needed for someone else who needs the urgent medical care because of this pandemic that we're going through.
That's absolutely right, Kushal. I mean, during the level 5 lockdown, we saw a massive and substantial decline in unnatural deaths in South Africa. And that was partly a result of alcohol, partly also a result of travel restrictions, mobility, fewer people on the roads, fewer people in cars, fewer traffic accidents. But it did free up hospital beds. And what we do need to remember is that, you know, having spent some time speaking to the Western Cape Department of Health recently, it takes, you know, up to 4 weeks to launch a new emergency facility. And then do you have staff for it? So it's very difficult to buy bed capacity, hospital bed capacity, as fast as you can by reducing trauma and alcohol-associated violence and car accidents. So by sticking away from the alcohol and the roads and the violence, we really will free up a substantial amount of hospital bed capacity to look after those who do acquire COVID, unfortunately, during this season.
And the interesting thing that stood out for me also was that the moment that we went back to, what was it, level 3, where the sale of alcohol was reintroduced, albeit, you know, cut back hours. So, you know, sort of similar to what we have at the moment, where it was only on sale from Monday through to Thursday, you know, limited trading hours, et cetera, et cetera. One of the first things, and I can't remember who I specifically spoke to during that period, but one of the key things that stood out for me immediately was the fact that you had this massive upsurge again of people pitching up in hospital with, I don't know, axes buried in their heads and stab wounds in the guts and goodness knows whatever else. Because why? We get drunk and then we get irresponsible. So I guess that plays a major role. I'm going to ask you a bit of a controversial question there, Doctor. Do you think then that we should go back to restrictions that keep our grubby little hands away from alcohol during this period if things don't get better and get better quickly?
Tough question, and I'm glad I'm not the one making the decision. especially sort of Christmas coming up, and we all want to have our glass of, you know, something with our Christmas celebrations. I think that in provinces and places where we are facing the healthcare system becoming overburdened, it's certainly something that the policymakers have to consider. It's a bit of a sledgehammer approach. What would be preferable is that if people took individual responsibility for ensuring, first of all, that they keep say social distancing, that they decrease their risk of transmission, but also that they manage themselves in a responsible way. I'm not massively in favor of centralized lockdown restrictions. But in certain instances, if the healthcare system is overwhelmed and if there are no hospital beds available, it certainly is an option which we have to keep on the cards, on the table, in our toolbox for buying hospital capacity.
Well, it's needed. Look, I guess also the economy took a massive knock. So what government is trying to do, and I mean, it's I guess to some extent blatantly obvious now that previously, I guess if this was in another part of the year, government would have probably taken us back to level 5, level 4, whatever level, you know, would sort of mitigate the current spread. But the economy has taken a massive knock. And again, we faced with that horrible decision of having to decide whether you eat to stay alive, you know, thereby being able to support your family, et cetera, during this particular difficult period. Or do you stop people's economic activity in an effort to try to keep them alive? So damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I guess that is why we do not have these overwhelming restrictions, at least not nationally, but only in certain parts of the country. And those particular restrictions in themselves are definitely not akin to what we saw during level 5 nationally.
That's right. I mean, I think it's important to remember that even at the end of the level 5 lockdown of the 5 weeks, that the reproductive number, which is the average number of secondary cases arising from an infected person, was more than one, suggesting we had a growing epidemic at the end of level 5. So even with extensive lockdown restrictions, we had a growing epidemic. And I think we have to bear this in mind when we think about how we respond to the current second wave. That we, even with enormous restrictions, we weren't able to reduce the reproductive number to below one. So I certainly think that the government is reluctant to push us back towards, you know, more restrictive lockdowns. But that needs to be balanced by the individual responsibility of the public to assess their risk, to know their risk in the areas where they live or where they're thinking of moving to for their holidays, and to assist us to reduce the transmission of COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 so that we can preserve life and livelihood simultaneously. We've all got to do this together. It's a very blunt toolbox when the government starts imposing restrictions from a centralized perspective.
It is, and it has a massive impact. And again, I mean, just to echo what you were saying there, it's something that we just don't absolutely need. One of the key things that came out of was a question that I saw via the WhatsApp line, and unfortunately, I've managed to track it down. Someone says, "Yeah, hi, Gersh. Well, I'm anonymous in Northwest. I would like to know what are the procedures that should be followed when an employee tested positive for COVID-19. One of the employees at one of the major supermarket chains, I don't want to mention which one, in Northwest tested positive, but they didn't even close the shop. They only fumigated the shop during the night. And the following day, they went back to business." I mean, is that okay for businesses to operate in that way? I'm not too sure exactly what the regulations would be specifically under those circumstances. But here you have an employee in one of the major chain retailers testing positive for COVID-19. They shut down overnight, do a quick, fumigation. And then the next day, they open for business. I mean, is that good enough? Because that in itself is another concern.
I think we've got to take into account that when we're sort of seeing 8,000 to 10,000 new confirmed cases being reported a day, that if we close down every business every time an employee tests positive, the economic consequences would be appalling. And there's certainly no requirement for it. What is necessary is to identify the people who are potentially in close contact with the person who's tested positive and make sure that they go into quarantine, and if they develop symptoms, they should be tested. So that means other people, other staff members in the store. It's also perhaps a reason to encourage people to download the app, which allows people to be notified if they spent more than 15 minutes in close proximity to a staff member who's positive. Mm-hmm. Maybe an alert, and they'll know that they're exposed and that they need to take suitable actions. But certainly there's no need for prolonged shutdown of facilities or stores or workplaces on the basis of a single of a case within a workspace.
Two things that stand out for me is, you know, the education drive the government has undertaken around COVID-19. You know, I think the government, especially in the beginning, did a hell of a lot. And I think that, you know, my three-year-old daughter is an example. The moment we leave the house, the first thing she always asks me is, where's my mask? And the moment you walk through a door, she puts out a hand knowing that it needs to be sanitized. So I guess from an education perspective, enough has been done, quite frankly. From my own personal perspective, do you think that government could have done more? Do you think that the state and other actors in that space, whether it be civil society, whether it be Chapter 9 organizations, whoever else has an interest in the faith-based communities, do you think that they need to play a bigger role in terms of education around this? Because I don't think, personally, and the reason why I'm asking that question in the first place is because I don't think it's a lack of education any longer. I just think it's a lack of compliance and maybe COVID fatigue and people just misbehaving at the moment.
Education is a tough one, Gushwal. It's not just about education and repetitive messaging. It's about the right type of messaging and allowing people to reach for and imagine a brighter and better future, which they can contribute to through their actions. So behavior change is complex, and the Ministerial Advisory Committee, in fact, has a behavioral change a committee which deals specifically with these questions. And I do think we could do better around it. I think that we've got to move away from messages which promote fear to ones which promote a wish for a better future and a better outcome with COVID for the country and for the community as a whole. I think the other thing that's absolutely essential is that we've got to communicate to people, give them an idea of what their risk is and the areas where they live and the district in which they reside, allow them to see the information. And as part of the South African COVID Modeling Consortium, we've built a dashboard which allows people in real time, it's updated 3 or 4 times a week, to go onto an open public access website and look at their district and see what the curve looks like and see what the hospital admissions for the province look like, to really try and get a sense and help them to make better informed decisions. And ideally, that information needs to be made available at a sub-district or lower level to people to make informed decisions about risk. So I think there are two aspects. We've got to lead by example. We've got to communicate and allow people to make nuanced decisions. I think we've got to communicate the fact that we can't get our risk to zero. That it's not appropriate, and it's not possible for individuals to get their risk of acquiring COVID to zero. But we really have to provide nuanced messaging to people about assessing or thinking about how much risk they're prepared to take, and then how do they expend that risk pool in a way which optimizes joy and mental health and happiness in a responsible way. So how do people really responsibly expend the risk that they're prepared to take is the important thing. So I don't think that nuanced communication has necessarily been fulfilled adequately, and I think we could do a better job. I suppose the truth is that we're still all learning in the face of a rapidly evolving environment. So I suppose my message to people is individuals, think about your personal risk. Think about your age, whether you have obesity, diabetes, heart disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, possibly TB, possibly HIV. Think about your personal risk, and then think about how much risk you're prepared to take given your personal health and given the circulating virus in your community, which you can look at on if I can give the web address on it's
by all means, please.
It's the SACMC Epidemic Explorer.co.za. If you log on to that, you can see in your district the level of circulating virus. So we've got to think about the community risk, our personal risk, and then you've got to think about, well, how do we spend that risk? And how do we mitigate and do it responsibly to make sure we don't put perhaps other vulnerable people in our orbits at risk of COVID. So certainly avoiding crowded spaces. And really the maths around that's quite simple. As the number of people in a gathering increases, the probability that not one of them has an infectious COVID infection decreases exponentially. All right. So as you have more people, the possibility that one of them is infectious increases exponentially. And so large gatherings really are at risk, and they result in these super spread events, not only because there's a greater chance that somebody's got it, but also there's a larger number of susceptible people to pass it to, right?
Exactly.
And so large gatherings really have to be avoided, especially in confined spaces. We do know that sort of transmission is massively increased in confined spaces where people are close together, poorly ventilated spaces. So avoid mass gatherings, avoid confined spaces, avoid crowds, and try and find our joy in a way which is outdoors, which decreases our risk, maintain social distancing, use our masks where appropriate, sanitize our hands. The second wave is taking me by surprise. It is of a higher magnitude and a more rapid magnitude than I'd certainly anticipated. And we certainly do need to really take it quite seriously.
No, for sure. Definitely. The one thing that you also, you know, that I thought that I need to talk to you about, especially based on the fact that this is the area of work, you know, you being a senior medical epidemiologist at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases Center for Tuberculosis or TB. I mean, how are we doing on that particular front? Because one of the key concerns, you know, speaking to some of the medical experts, some of them who were part of the advisory council for government, was obviously that there's going to be such a major focus on COVID-19 that some of our other communicable diseases, particularly tuberculosis and I guess to a lesser extent HIV, would lose focus, you know, in the space. Have we seen a loss in focus? Have we seen a concern in that space? Or have we kept at least, you know, the treatment of tuberculosis under control?
It's a good question. What we have seen is, since the implementation of the level 5 lockdown, was a fairly dramatic decrease in the number of TB tests being conducted every month. And that really continued through levels 5, 4, and 3. And really only in levels 2 and 1 have we started increasing the numbers of TB tests again and getting back towards the sort of what we would have expected based on 2018 or 2019 data. So the estimate at the moment is possibly close on 500,000 TB tests fewer have been conducted this year than would have been conducted in the absence of COVID. And of those, we probably, the number of positive cases that we're missing, or that we've diagnosed between March and the end of November, approximately 30,000 fewer TB cases than we would otherwise have expected. Now, what's not entirely clear is what the impact of the lockdown and masks and sanitation have been on TB transmission. It's likely that TB transmission, with people spending more time at home, would have concentrated within households, but TB transmission within communities or between communities would likely possibly have decreased due to decreased mobility and decreased contact and effective contract rates. So we're working quite hard to develop some modeling around this to try and assess the transmission of TB, to try and assess the impact on TB, but certainly it is a cause for concern. And it was driven by, I believe, a number of factors. I think that the health system pivoted very quickly to dealing with COVID and, you know, almost exclusively COVID. I think lockdowns resulted in decreased access to transport. People perhaps couldn't get to clinics, though a large proportion of South Africa do live within a walking distance of a clinic. But then I believe there possibly the fear of acquiring COVID during the high peak of the first wave results in people avoiding healthcare facilities. And that is enormous concern. People do need to continue to look after their other health conditions, their diabetes, their cardiac conditions, their HIV, their TB. And certainly if any person's got a cough and you get tested for COVID, you really should also be tested for tuberculosis, right? The symptoms are very similar. It's also a respiratory illness. And really, we should be testing people who are being tested for COVID for TB as well. And it would dramatically improve perhaps our control of TB going forward and provide a silver lining to what has otherwise been a very dark cloud.
Doctor, I mean, looking at, and unfortunately we only have 3 minutes left for a riveting conversation there. I mean, with the new strain of COVID-19, again, it spreads quicker, but doesn't seem to be more virulent than the current strain of COVID-19, but definitely a problem, at least coming from the Eastern and Western Cape. Any concerns there, any worries there?
We've got a lot more work to do. So obviously it is a concern. It does have three significant mutations, and some of those mutations are at least theoretically associated with changes in the functional characteristics of the virus, how well it transmits, et cetera. However, there's much more work to be done. And we at the NICD is working incredibly hard to look both at whether the virus is more transmissible, to look at whether there's more severity, and to think about the complications, you know, the other issues surrounding this new strain. So while it's still early days, it is of concern, but we've got a lot more work to do to properly characterize the likely impacts of this new strain or lineage on transmissibility and severity. There are other questions out there which have to be answered too. Is there a possibility that the mutations in the new lineage could result in people who were previously infected being infected again? And so these are the kinds of questions we're having to answer. And I can assure you and the public that there are enormous teams of highly qualified scientists, both within CRISP and CAPRISA and NICD, who are all working night and day to try and answer these questions as rapidly as we can.
And on that, just as a final factor, my wife and I had a conversation, you know, driving around in the car earlier today. And the one thing that stood out for us is both of us didn't get the flu. No one got a cold. And I would say, yes, obviously lesser movements and being restricted more at home, number one. But number two, I think a major factor that had a role to play in that is sanitizing your hands, washing your hands continuously and wearing a mask. I mean, is this something that would suggest is an ongoing feature, a mainstay of our lives going forward? And I guess gone are the days where if you were at the airport and you saw Chinese nationals at the airport, either traveling to or coming from China wearing their masks, I guess there's a lesser likelihood of anyone now, you know, pointing a finger and giggling or looking at them strangely. Seemingly, it's the way to go now.
Well, I can tell you that ID or infectious diseases specialists always look at horror at people who shake hands. And it's certainly a tradition and a ritual that should be binned with history. Shaking hands, while it's a part of many cultures, is certainly a very effective way of transmitting respiratory viruses. So hand sanitization is certainly important. And I think that, you know, we've seen not only reductions in things like influenza, but we've also seen reductions in perhaps childhood illnesses, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, other respiratory viruses. And so sanitizing, you know, appropriate hygiene is certainly one that has been a remarkable insight into what we can achieve. I think that what we do also have to balance it with is in going into the future is our society and our cultures. So it'll be interesting to see where we come up. But certainly I think hand sanitizing, washing our hands, is certainly something we must carry forward into the future.
100%. Doctor, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. All the best to you.
Thank you so much, Kushwal. Take care. Good evening to your listeners. Have a good night.
You too. Cheers. It's 10 o'clock.